Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready for your oral argument from petitioners in the consolidated original mandamus proceedings of Epic and George versus Brown and Snodgrass. Justice Enoch is voluntarily recusing.
May it please the court. The relators will be represented by Mary Ann and Mr. Robert Miss Yates will present the first 5 minutes. She will also reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honors, I'm going to do the first 9 minutes, and then Mr. Mao will continue the opening. This is an attorney
disqualification.
I'm sorry, Judge. This is an attorney disqualification case where a team of lawyers at the former firm of Johnson & Gibbs represented Epic, or later Epic, it's my client, and did millions of dollars in legal work for Epic to set up Epic, to structure it as an employee-owned corporation. And now, members of the team of those lawyers who did that work and their new law firms are attacking Epic. Now, on this graphic, Johnson & Gibbs firm, the red people are the people who were on the team that did the work. There were about 20 of those lawyers. And we've listed Mr. Jordan and Mr. Carter, who thereafter joined the Jordan firm and the McCool firm, because they happen to be the two people from the team of lawyers who are involved here. But there were actually 20 lawyers at the Johnson & Gibbs firm who I say were the red team, the red guys at the Johnson & Gibbs firm, did all of this work, all these various issues, the corporate work, the securities work, the hospital work, to form Epic. And then the two of the red team members, Mr. Jordan joined the Jordan firm, Mr. Carter joined the McCool firm. And then there were the blue guys at Johnson & Gibbs. Those are the lawyers who were at Johnson & Gibbs at the time, but were not on the red team. And the blue guys joined the McCool firm. And then the McCool firm and the Jordan firm entered into a joint venture agreement. There's a written copy of it in the record. The purpose of the joint venture agreement, we say, Your Honors, was to attack the work product of the red team while they were at Johnson & Gibbs and when they were setting up Epic. And this purpose was carried out by reconstituting significant players from the old Johnson & Gibbs firm. And who were those players? It was Mr. McCool, who had been on the Johnson & Gibbs Management Committee for 9 years, while Epic, my client, the relator, was their largest client in the year 1988. Epic paid $2.5 million in legal fees for the work of the red team in setting Epic up. And who else was in this joint venture? The top litigators from the old Johnson & Gibbs firm, Mr. McCool, Mr. Cunningham. And who else was in this joint venture? Importantly, the business lawyers who were on the red team who put Epic together, including Mr. Jordan and Mr. Carter. So that's the players that are involved here. And we believe, Your Honors, that under the clear reading of Disciplinary Rule 1.09, which we recognize is not binding on you for procedural disqualification, but we believe informs the analysis, that under a clear reading of 109, these lawyers would be disqualified.
Yes, would you address the River Center Associates, you know, waiver of complaint because you slept on your rights. You didn't complain for a long time.
Yes, Your Honor. If you look at the nature of our bases for disqualification, the nature of our bases is paragraph A1 of the rule, which is attack on work product, attack on the work product of the red team. That, first of all, was not the basis of the first motion to disqualify. But in any event, we can't have a waiver of that basis for disqualification unless we know about it. Unless we know about it. And comment 10 to Rule 109 says you can't have a waiver unless you know what the intended role of the lawyer is going to be. So unless you can find from this record that we should have known or we knew that they were going to attack work product, you can't find a waiver. And the reason that we say there's no waiver as a matter of law, and that's why there's no fact question on waiver to preclude mandamus here, is because they told us and told us and told us that they would not attack work product. It started in October of 1994. These are some of their statements. They said the plaintiff will not challenge the documents that were drafted in 1988. And the 1988 is the work of the red team that I hope to be able to demonstrate to Your Honors is exactly what they challenged in this trial. And they said, any fair reading of our pleadings will confirm that we do not challenge the 1988 transaction. And they said, we don't challenge the 1988 creation of Epic. And Your Honors, they made these statements in sworn answers to requests for admission in sworn answers in August of 1995, and they never withdrew those sworn answers. And it's our position, Your Honor, that there's no way that we're supposed to know they were not telling us the truth. And then we get to trial, and what do? They attack the work product. And that's what I'd like to demonstrate to Your Honors as to why and why that's true. What was the work product of the red team, the red group of lawyers at Johnson & Gibbs who put EPIC together? What was their work product? They created an employee-owned corporation that had an ESOP, an employee stock ownership plan. And the evidence in the record is that they told EPIC, we're going to put this together for you by the book. It will sustain any challenge. This will be by the book. And by the way, when you put this ESOP together and you put this employee-owned company together, you need an integrity, you need a trustee for the ESOP who has integrity. And the Johnson & Gibbs lawyers told them, don't hire that trustee you were going to hire. These are the red guys back in 1988. They said, hire this trustee because he has integrity. And they sat in on the meetings and helped them pick the trustee. And the plaintiff's lawyers tell you in the brief they filed last Friday, we didn't attack the integrity of the trustee when we got to trial. But look at what Mr. McCool and Mr. Cunningham said at trial. At trial, Mr. McCool said, the evidence is going to show that the reason that this ESOP trustee went along with the health care merger is because they paid him $350,000 over and above his regular fee. And Mr. Cunningham said, now the trustee was paid $350,000. And when the issue was raised, well, why is that relevant to this case? Mr. Cunningham told the trial court, the issue of the bribe, what I call the bribe, the $350,000, that goes to the heart of why the trustee went along with the merger. In other words, the trustee's lack of integrity, the fact that he would take a bribe. And remember, this is the trustee that the red guys at Johnson & Gibbs told him to hire because of his integrity. And they come to trial, and these are the former Johnson & Gibbs partners now.
When did these folks leave Johnson & Gibbs?
The McCool group left Johnson & Gibbs in 1991, Your Honor. In July 31 of 1991.
Okay.
They, and Jordan had previously left Johnson & Gibbs to join the Jordan Pennington Fund.
Okay, and they're talking about something that happened in 1988.
In 1988. And remember what their promises were, Justice Spector. They repeatedly said, we will not attack the 1988 documents. We will not attack.
No. When are they? What year is this?
This is in the 1996 trial.
When did they make the payments is what Judge Spector said.
Oh, I'm sorry. The payments were made in connection with the merger. The payment to the trustee was made in connection
with
the merger.
What year is that?
The merger, I believe, was 95.
Okay.
94 or 95.
Can't they argue that that is part of what they said in the first place? That no, we're not attacking the work product, we're attacking the payments that were made when the merger came about.
But, Your Honor, in attacking the payment and the fact that the trustee would go along with the merger to accept the payment,
mm-hmm.
they're attacking the integrity of the trustee. And part of the work product...
Well, isn't it possible he could have been okay in 1988, but got a change of heart in 1994?
That he was not a trustee of integrity?
No, that he was honest or dishonest.
Well, Your Honor, that's possible. I still believe that's attacking the integrity of the individual who was chosen. I mean, agreeing to the merger was the very type of thing that the trustee for the ESOP mm-hmm. would have been selected to do. So this is the work of the trustee that they're selecting the trustee to do, and the red guys at Johnson & Gibbs are telling EPIC, pick this trustee because he's got integrity.
Isn't that like any other employee?
I'm sorry, Ron.
Well, it seems to me that this just has to do with an employee of the client.
Could I show you why that is important? Let's put up a circle of power, Bobby. One of their themes at trial of the plaintiff's lawyers, the former Johnson & Gibbs lawyers, was this structure that the red team put together for EPIC was really a circle of power. And the trustee, the fellow we were just talking about, he's part of the circle of power. And this is just not a pretty drawing that we did for the oral argument, Your Honor. That is a reproduction of the drawing the plaintiff's lawyers here, the ex-Johnson & Gibbs lawyers, did at trial, made for the jury to show how the structure of EPIC that was put together in 1988 was really a sham and a fraud, because it was never going to be really an employee-empowered corporation. Let's put up that one, Robbie. It was always going to be a circle of power because the directors controlled the ESOP committee, and the ESOP committee controlled the trustee, and the trustee voted for the directors. So they set up this circle of power, and they had to do it, Your Honors, because they had to get rid of the trustee. The trustee would come to trial and say this was a fair merger. So they had to undercut the trustee, and the way they did it is he didn't have any integrity. He took bribes. And number two, he was just a puppet of the board. And who set up this structure, who set it up, was the red guy that Johnson & Gibbs. And look at what Mr. Cunningham, the ex-Johnson & Gibbs partner, this is when he's cross-examining his former partners, Mr. Watson. And if you read that testimony, what is so striking to you is that if you had walked into the room and listened to it, you would have sworn that it was a malpractice case against Johnson & Gibbs. Because he repeatedly would say, now this document says this, and it allowed this. And your firm, Johnson & Gibbs, set that up, didn't they? And here's what Mr. Cunningham says. The way the governance of this employee-owned company is set up, the employees don't have any power. And the way this worked, it was a circle of power that allowed the board to perpetuate themselves forever. And so the employees were not empowered. In other words, in the words of Professor Schuer, who was one of the redactors of Rule 109, they came to trial and they attacked the entire setup of EPIC as a sham and a fraud on the employees. And who set up EPIC? The red team from Johnson & Gibbs. And so this is clearly an attack on their work product.
What did you think their attack was going to be at trial?
Well, they told us, Your Honor, Judge Owens, that they would not attack the 88 transactions, and that they were going to say that the documents were valid and that we just breached the documents. And that's what they're trying to convince you of in this mandamus, too. Which I think is too cute by half, but we weren't really attacking the documents. We were just attacking the misuse of the documents. But as you can see from looking at their attack on the circle of power, they're attacking the very structure of EPIC that the red people at Johnson & Gibbs set up. And so it is an attack on work product. And I need to let Mr. Mao have his...
Any other questions?
Before Mr. Mao represents somebody else, then.
Yes, sir.
I've looked in the record, and I can't seem to find the administrative judge's order that assigned Judge Snodgrass to this case. Can you tell me where it is?
Your Honor, I can't give you the site right at this minute, but I believe it's in there. But could I say, Your Honor, are you going to the issue of whether or not Judge Snodgrass was...
Well, that's one of the orders you're attacking. I hadn't heard anything about
you're
it
right,
yet.
And I'm glad you asked the question, because we abandoned that complaint.
We
abandoned that complaint. We've looked at it more carefully. We think Judge Snodgrass that there was not a valid challenge, and we abandoned that part of our mandate.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Kevin.
May it please the Court, I'm Bob Mao. I represent Ken George, an individual who was a client of the Johnson & Gibbs firm at the time that this matter first came into the firm. My client, Mr. George, took this matter to Jim Watson and said it was going to be a management buyout, and I want you to represent me, and I want you to tell me how to put this deal together. What should it do? Who should be the employees? How should we structure it? There were 30 hospitals that ultimately came to be EPIC. There was no EPIC at that time. The representation of Mr. George should be undisputed. Jim Watson said it was a representation. Mr. George said it was a representation. Mr. McClure, the ERISA specialist, said it was a representation. Mr. Frankel, the tax specialist, said it was. Mr. Cunningham grilled his former partner, saying, you represented Ken George personally, didn't you? So I don't think there's any question about my client being a client of Johnson & Gibbs. And the policy question before this court is, are you going to allow in this state side-switching lawyers in a breach of fiduciary duty case to take advantage of every document, every structure, and even mistakes, if there were any, of that firm to the disadvantage of a client like Mr. George? That's the question. I think this court answered that question in NME. Whether it's strictly under Rule 109 and the analysis that Ms. Yates has given, or whether it's under an appearance of impropriety. Either way, the answer clearly should be no. In this state, we are not going to allow side-switching attorneys to do that. On pages 11 through 16 of our brief...
Let me ask you a question about what you said. Are you arguing as a standard the appearance of impropriety?
I'm arguing that is an alternative that this court can use in addition to Rule 109.
But how do we pin that down without it being a gray area in almost every case like this?
I don't know that that's easy. And I think that is difficult. But I think where you have a case like this, you have benchmarks that can be applied. You have a substantial relationship. You have lawyers who worked on the transaction who went over to each of these firms. And you have an attack made on the services, which is a word in 109, and the work product. So you have three benchmarks. And then you have a case where the lawyers questioned everything that they did and took advantage of it. And all I can do is ask you to read those examinations of Mr. Cunningham and Mr. McCool. And they took advantage of it to the disadvantage of my client. And may I give one other answer?
Does anybody want to hear one other answer?
Judge Ryder said yes.
Thank you. The real difficulty in a case like this is the former lawyers, Mr. McCool and Mr. Cunningham especially, so they didn't work on the team, and although we say they're infected under Rule 109, they stand up there as senior members, Mr. McCool is on the board of directors, and to a jury, they are saying, we were there. We were there when this deal was put together. Those words don't come out of their mouth, but they are the avenging angels. Well, we were there. We know how Tim Watson did things. We know Ken George, and let us tell you how it went. And Mr. George abused all his power, that's their claim. And if that's not an appearance of impropriety, I don't know what is, and it is impossible for a client in this state like Mr. George to overcome that before a jury.
Any other questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you very much.
The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondents.
May it please the court, Mr. Bobby Morrison will present argument to the respondents.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Lonnie Morris, and I represent the real party in interest in this proceeding. There are many very important issues in this case that haven't been touched upon. For example, it is disputed that Ken George was a client of the Johnson Gibson Law Firm. There's in 50 boxes of paper that was subpoenaed, there's not one document that reflects that he's a client. There's not $1 that was ever billed to him or paid by him. There were disinterested witnesses who said he was not a client of that firm, that were on the red team, as they call it here. He didn't object to the production of the documents in the mandamus proceeding he tried to bring to you, that was brought to you a year and a half ago, claiming they were privileged as to him. It was only Epic, the corporation, that objected at that time.
Could Johnson and Gibbs draft his compensation?
They drafted the employment contracts, yes. They were terminated then in 1994, and it's the termination of those contracts of which complaint is made. The plaintiff testified in this case unequivocally. She had not one objection, not one complaint whatsoever to the compensation that had been paid to Mr. George pursuant to the employment contracts up until 1994. In 1994, what happened was the company was sold for $250 million. It had been valued the same month outside the knowledge of the beneficial owners, the employees, that had their claims through an ESOP program at more than $100,000, $100 million in excess of that. And as part of the resolution, part of this business transaction, Mr. George and some other insiders walked away with about $44 million in lieu of their rights under those existing contracts that had been written by Johnson Gibbs. Not pursuant to, but in lieu of. In fact, there's a document in evidence here that was written in 1993, 2 years after everybody that's been mentioned left Johnson Gibbs, where one Johnson Gibbs partner tells another, this payment is not authorized by the existing agreements. That's what the complaint is about. There's no complaint about 1988 and the way this was set up. Evidence shows...
I thought there was a complaint that if it had been set up another way, this couldn't have happened.
No. There was a complaint, Your Honor, that there was a gradual empowerment that was included, that initially you have this circle of power, and that over time, the share rights vest in individual beneficiaries of the ESOP plan, and they can direct the voting of the trustee with respect to the shares that are allocated to their respective accounts. So over a period of time, there was empowerment of the employees. The change was made in 1991, immediately before some of these people left that law firm, but there was no effect to that change for 13 months till they have the next meeting and give notice to the employees. They never gave notice to the employees, and they never had another meeting after that time. That's the only complaint that arises out of that issue you raised, is that the company never told the employees they had power to vote. And that was 13, could have been 13 months after the departure. There are other reasons besides the ones I've given that clearly show that Mr. George was not a client of Johnston Gibbs, connection with this transaction or any of these predicates, and never claimed to be until late in this process. This, when I say this process, this is not the first motion to disqualify. 17 months before this motion was filed, another motion to disqualify was filed. They lost that motion to disqualify. They didn't take mandamus at that time. They raised, that mandamus petition is in your record. They raised in that petition expressly a complaint that these lawyers were going to attack work product. The complaint, that the motion they filed in June of 1996 is a nothing but cold biscuit warmed up again, trying to get into a mandamus position.
What's Mr. Cunningham's testimony, or how could they, please respond to Ms. Yates' argument. This, you cannot compare apples and oranges here. That mandamus was on a certain set of facts, but this mandamus we're here today is completely different due, in fact, to the testimony at trial. Mr. Cunningham and some other gentlemen.
Mr. Cunningham and Mr. McCool.
Mr. McCool, correct.
They asked some questions, but of course questions, there's no pleadings, there's no motions. The rules, the words of Rule 109 say, and I recognize that that's not the only controlling standard for procedural disqualification, those rules say that you attack the validity of the documents. There was never an attack on the validity of the documents. In order to show the abuse of power, you first have to show the existence of power. All of that work talking about the 1988 arrangement and how it evolved after that was to show the existence of power. In 1994, you had a gross abuse of that power. I want to show you just as an example, one of these charts that they haven't yet referred to, but probably will, criticized Mr. Cunningham just as an example for saying that Johnston Gibbs drafted these documents, didn't they, Mr. Watson? Listen to the context at which that comes, and it's volume 6 of the 11 document record. Mr. Cunningham says, we'll offer exhibit 245. Mr. Sims, he hasn't authenticated. I object. There's no foundation. The court sustained. Mr. Watson, question. Mr. Watson, are you familiar with the employee stock ownership plan of EFI? I remember there was a plan, sure. And you know Johnston Gibbs drafted it, don't you, Mr. Watson? Now, is that an attack on work product? I mean, to try to authenticate a document with a lawyer who was a principal lawyer.
What about that exhibit? Is that fair representation of what plaintiffs offered at trial or used demonstrably at trial?
Are you talking about the circuit, the one on the right? Yes, ma'am. That exhibit, I wasn't in the trial. I've only been in this case for a few weeks. But it's my understanding that I heard Ms. Yates say that was actually an exhibit of the defendants at trial or something similar, of the plaintiff at trial or something similar to that. Maybe it's on the blackboard or something. I don't really know. But it is true that circle of power argument was made because it is, in fact, the way things existed in 88. And in 91, there was an amendment to the documents that would have changed that. But it never changed in reality because while they changed it on paper to satisfy the IRS, they never told the employees they had a right to vote themselves. They always left the impression the trustee would vote. And in fact, they just quit having meetings. They perpetuated that circle of power after the documents that were prepared by Johnson and Gibbs in 88, 89, 90, and 91 would have drastically altered that. I'd just like to say a couple other quick things. So I say to you, with respect to that, there's no attack on work product here. There's an effort to show, as any good trial lawyer would, the existence of power as a predicate to show the abuse of power.
But it looks like you'd also argue, if you were, as you say, a good lawyer for that side, that it never should have been set up that way in the first place.
I don't think there's really any choice about it, Judge. I don't think that anybody has been critical of that, and the plaintiff was very careful to say that she had no criticism of the way it was set up, none whatsoever. The trial judge in this case has had to make many unique factual determinations. One thing you haven't been told yet, it's attached to the pleadings in this case, and I've got an exhibit over here, but I think instead of wasting the time to show it to you, well, it's marked with your clerk's office, so it'll be here. There was an assignment by Epic to the plaintiff in this case of any claims that Epic had against Mr. George and the other insiders, an assignment. So when she pursued this litigation, she pursued it as an assignee. As a matter of law, you cannot be adverse if you stand in the shoes. You can't be adverse to a party whose shoes you're standing in. When Epic assigned their rights against the insiders, including Mr. George, to the plaintiff, which they did in this lawsuit, and they were dismissed ultimately from this lawsuit, then under those circumstances, there's no adversity. If there's no adversity under Rule 109, if you're not asserting a claim adverse to a former client, then both substantial relationship of Part A3 and work product attacks on validity under A1 are irrelevant. You don't meet the requirements. So when you look at this, you think trial judge made some real strong factual determinations in this case that were not in, for example, your NME case.
Mr. Morrison.
Yes.
Didn't that assignment say that it was without waiver of Epic's claim that the plaintiff had no standing to file a suit at the outset?
Yes.
Is that material in your argument?
No. It does say that, but it's not material because the standing issue is another issue that has factual connotations in it that will have to be resolved by some method other than mandamus. I agree with the things that both the majority and the dissent said in NME about the use of mandamus, and one of those things that both sides obviously agreed upon is that this is not an appropriate remedy for an intensive factual determination case. And there's some facts that are going to be relevant in the determination of standing that haven't yet been adjudicated.
No, I didn't mean to say that whether she had standing is an issue here in this mandamus, but does it affect the nature of your adversity argument?
Well, it would. I think I agree with what you said, Justice Baker. That's right. But the trial court had to make an issue with the biggest factual issue in the trial court. You've written before that waiver is inherently a factual determination. The biggest judgment the trial court had to make is, has there been a waiver, a failure to timely assert this action? Remember, this case was filed in April of 1994. It was removed to federal court by the defendants. It was thrown out of federal court, and the defendants were sanctioned for doing so. They filed a motion to disqualify it in May of 95 that involves a whole range of essentially everything that is included here. There was a two-day hearing, and at that two-day hearing, a big, big issue was, have they waived any right if they had a right? And the court held no. I'm sorry. Court held yes, they have waived it. No, they have no continuing right.
Which judge held waiver?
Candace Tyson was the one that made that particular decision. And then,
but Epic was not involved in the case at the time Judge Tyson ruled on the motion by the directors. Isn't that correct?
Epic was not in the case at that time. That's right. Then Epic's only in the case now because they've intervened right before this mandamus was filed for the purpose of this complaint. That's right. But there was...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Justice Spector, but there was also a second hearing on the motion that comes here by mandamus, Judge Hugh Snodgrass, and he also ruled there was waiver, and Epic was a party at that time.
But he didn't say that in his order.
No, but without findings of fact or conclusions of law, you would assume that he found everything that would be necessary to support the order he made.
On the assignment that Epic made to the plaintiff?
Yes, ma'am.
Give me some context of when that was in relation to the lawsuit and the merger.
Okay. Your Honor, the lawsuit was filed in April of 1994, and a temporary restraining order was obtained in joining the merger. That 4 days after the temporary restraining order was issued, which was the same day the lawsuit was filed, Epic made that assignment to the plaintiff, and the plaintiff withdrew her request for injunctive relief to block the merger. And that was all in April of 1994. Then, so you have these factual determinations, and what, you know, I look back at what this court's done in the last 10 years, and I read this record, and candidly, I think it's pretty harsh, pretty vitriolic, pretty critical. See, what's this court done with respect to the areas of ethics and professionalism? And, you know, in the last 10 years, actually in the last 8 years, you've been promulgated the very rules that we're talking about here under 109. You've enacted the disciplinary rules of procedure, or the rules of disciplinary procedure. You've amended the rules with respect to advertising restrictions. You've set up the Commission for Lawyer Discipline. You've set up the Board of Disciplinary Appeals. You've adopted the Code of Professionalism, and you clearly have a deep interest in that. But you don't have such a deep interest in that. We're all interested in that, but you can't have such a deep interest in that you're willing to throw away all the other rules, such as that waiver is a factual determination and not an appropriate matter to be reviewed on mandamus. You need to review this in the context of a full transcript, because what you're seeing here, as the one portion I quoted, is terribly misguided, terribly incomplete. It misrepresents the facts.
On the waiver issue?
On many issues with respect to, if you look at the motion for disqualification that was filed back in 1995, you'll see that it includes the attacks they bring to you now and say are fresh, that they learned them at trial.
What about the affidavits that were filed at that time?
There were no affidavits, if I understand your question, responses to requests for admissions. They were correct when they were made. They were correct continuously thereafter, and they're still correct. They said, do you question the 1988 documents? And we said, no, we didn't then, we don't now. The 1988 documents are relevant to show the existence of power, and a transfer of power over time. You have to know what power exists to determine if there's been an abuse of it. If you want to see if the trustee has breached a fiduciary duty, you have to see the duties, responsibilities, and relationships that are pertinent to that role as a fiduciary of the trustee. And this is very much like that. I'd remind you, we've never had an opportunity at either hearing to put on any experts. There's a two-day hearing to listen to the defendant's objections about a motion for disqualification. Judge says they've heard enough, they're not disqualified. We didn't get to put on our experts. They talk about what they're said, but we didn't get to put on ours. Same thing happened before Judge Snodgrass. Now, this is not a case that comes to you with even a complete record with respect to the limited state that we're in. We've never put on, the only record that has ever been allowed by the defendants is cross-examination with respect to this.
Are you saying you didn't have an opportunity to put on whatever evidence you wanted to?
The judge said, I've heard enough, I'm ruling. Weren't trying to build a record for you at that point in time.
Would I suspect that you didn't ask for more time after ruling in your favor?
It's not my practice. Afraid I might change the judge's mind.
Yes,
when the judge rules, I usually sit down and go home.
That's not a very strong argument in this case.
Well, it is in the sense that, not that we were deprived of it, but it's very strong in the sense that you're not looking at a complete record. I mean, you're not looking at all of the evidence that exists with respect to the issues that are brought here to you. And so when you say, I'm going to put my mandamus hat on and apply the standards of mandamus, and say, you know, was there a reasonable choice this judge could have made other than the one, or was the choice that he made wrong, was it totally unreasonable? And I think that the answer to it first is that on the record before the court, it was a very reasonable decision, but it was a factual determination.
Well, you're not arguing that they didn't bring a record sufficient to sustain their side on the issue that we have now, which is...
I'm saying that they didn't, that they brought the record that they had, but it's not sufficient to justify mandamus.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Your Honor, on Justice Baker's question, tabs 23, 24, and 25 of the booklet are the statements that were made in the disqualification hearing before Judge Snodgrass, which is the one you're here on today, where it was very clear that the plaintiffs themselves introduced evidence, that the plaintiffs were entirely aware that Judge Snodgrass was going to take into account at the end of the hearing whether to accept our evidence, and that they knew that Judge Snodgrass had accepted our evidence. So there's no doubt, as Judge Baker pointed out, they had every opportunity to make an evidentiary hearing. So that, I agree with Judge Baker, is just not an issue.
Going back to the assignment.
Yes, ma'am.
Why doesn't that move this?
The assignment, as Mr. Morrison pointed out, was to allow the merger to go forward. But the assignment cannot assign the disqualification rights to the prior client. In other words, when Epic assigns its claim, whatever that claim is, to Ms. Vicki Anderson, she doesn't make Vicki Anderson the former client of Epic's former lawyer. She doesn't assign the disqualification right, is what I'm trying to say, Your Honor. It's an assignment of the cause of action, but it's not an assignment of the attorney-client relationship that existed between the red team and Epic. And you see, there is adversity, as Judge Heck wrote in NME, you know, you shouldn't have to stand under the tree when the lightning storm is all around you. There is adversity because there's clearly these indemnity agreements that require or may well require Epic to indemnify for the hundreds of millions of dollars that they're trying to collect from the directors. So there can't be any doubt.
Wait a minute, doesn't healthcare, didn't they say in the assignment itself that they pay everything, even whatever Epic owed at the end?
There are two sets of indemnities, Your Honor. The first set of indemnities are in the 1988 transaction.
But this is the last one.
And in the latter set, both Epic and healthcare agreed to indemnify.
Does Epic still exist?
Yes, sir. It was the surviving corporation in the reverse triangular merger. It does still exist, and that was their big argument at trial, is that Epic still existed. Now, on Judge Heck's question of whether or not this really is an attack on work product and whether this merger could have gone forward but for the governance of the circle of power, the circle of power is absolutely necessary to their contention, because you see, if the trustee of the ESOP had not gone along with the merger couldn't have taken place. And there were two attacks on their trial argument against the trustee, and one of them was the circle of power, i.e. the trustee was a puppet of the board by virtue of the circle of power. The other attack was the trustee took bribes and was a crook. And this is the trustee that the Johnson & Gibbs Red guy said, go hire, he's the one with integrity. So it's absolutely an attack on work product. Now,
if,
Judge,
on another matter, if under all the same initial circumstances, if Epic believed while Mr. George was still employed by it that he had embezzled money, could the Jordan and McCool firms sue Mr. George on behalf of Epic for that embezzlement?
This raises the 1.12 argument that they made in their latest brief. Your Honor, certainly under 1.12, the lawyers for the corporation may well have a duty under that rule to take remedial action. But this is really your question. Does that go to attacking the work product? Does that go to suing? Does that rule contemplate that you're going to turn around and sue the former client and attack your own work product? I don't think so. And that's what went on here, and that's the basis of the disqualification under 109. That's the distinction. And you're really writing on a clean slate here, Your Honors, because you've not written on 109A1 before. You've written all this disqualification law on the substantially related aspect. Remember, there's three subparts to Rule 109. One part is attacking work product. One part is the concern about confidence, and the other part is the substantially related. Those are the three subsets, and they overlap. But paragraph A1, attacking work product, vindicates policies that the others don't, and are at least more significantly vindicates those policies. And what are they? Loyalty. Loyalty to the client. I am not going to do the work and then turn around and say, the work I did for you is terrible, it was wrong, it was fraudulent. That's what A1 is going to. And paragraph B of that rule says, not only won't the red guys do it, the red guys won't turn around and do it, but the people who sit next door to the red guys in their law firm won't do it. So that means the Jordan firm and the McCool firm can't say, well, Mr. Jordan and Mr. Carter can't do it because they're red guys, but I'll get my partner next door to go attack their work product. And that's why those firms are disqualified. The red guys are disqualified, and their firms are disqualified. And it seems to us very clear under the language of Rule 109 that that's true, and the policies that you would want to vindicate by that. Now, this statement by Mr. Morrison that if you just read these snippets in the records, you'll see that all they were doing was trying to authenticate these documents. Your Honor, I'm sorry, but that's just not true. If you will just read the cross-examination by Mr. Cunningham of his former partner, Mr. Watson. Mr. Watson was the head of the red guys. He was the head of the red team. And he gets Mr. Watson on the stand, and he is not just authenticating those documents. He is repeatedly saying, and your law firm did it, and your law firm drafted that, didn't it? This document is fraudulent, and your law firm did it. He should have said, our law firm. Thank you.
Any other questions? That concludes the arguments and the final cause. All of these will be submitted on briefs and oral arguments. The marshal will now adjourn the court.
All right. Oh, yes, oh, yes, oh, yes.